You know, we all celebrate our birthdays. I mean, obviously, it's the beginning of our incarnation. It marks the most recent attempt on our part to use human life as it was intended to be used, to bring us into a state of realization with God. And all through the course of a lifetime, there are many significant events that mark watersheds in our efforts to expand our awareness in whatever form that may take, whether it's our awareness of intellectual knowledge or how to work with other people or make money or whatever it might be. We graduate from college, we get married, we may get divorced, we have the birth of our children, whatever it might be, there's all these watersheds. And oftentimes we can see how a certain number of things happen from that moment. Well, the moment Swami Kriyananda met Paramhansa Yogananda, there was a force set in motion that just literally brought us all right to this point. One of the statements that Master makes somewhere when he's talking about his promise to the disciples and his promise to bring each one of us who becomes a true disciple of his all the way to the state of God realization, he makes the statement that I or one of my disciples will come and take them and help them through. And so even Master's own words, you realize that the span of one incarnation, I have often thought of it in these simple terms, which is an avatar incarnates only occasionally. And we, even though we may be his devoted disciples, obviously are going to incarnate many times other than that. And even though it is possible to receive inspiration inwardly, it only makes sense that those who are on the same path with us, who yet are more advanced in the same ways that we're trying to follow, would, as part of their service to the Master, turn and help those behind them to come along that same walkway. And this is the role that Kriyananda has fulfilled for us to an astonishing degree because of all that he's created. It's very unusual for an individual of his spiritual stature to be so involved in the material world and creating as he has done, with books and music and communities and the Sangha, everything. As most of you know, my relationship with Swamiji began in 1969 when he gave a lecture over here at Stanford University. And the instant, literally, that I saw him, I was already a seeker. And I just intuitively know that he was the one who had been sent for me to learn from. And from that moment until the present, I've really done nothing else with my life except oriented toward working with the flow of inspiration that comes from him. I stood up here last year and spoke, I recall, in quavering tones with great intensity about the fact that since just a few years after I met Swamiji, the idea was always in my mind that someday I would write about him. It was a destiny that was just obvious to me right from the start. And right from the beginning, through all these years, I've taken notes of my own experiences with him and of experiences I observe, of things he tells me, of stories other people tell me. And for almost 4 or 5 years, I've sort of blotted it out. I struggled. For 3 years, I struggled in vain to write. And then at this time last year, I had finally found a way to write this book. And with great trepidation, for the first time, I shared it beyond a very small circle with all of you. And I must admit, I was thrilled by your response. And I was thrilled in my own ears to hear those words and see that in some way I had communicated what I have experienced. Well, now it's a year later, and it had been my fond hope that I would stand here now holding the published book. We're not quite going to make it. We're just about to go to the printer. It's going to go to the printer in about 3 weeks. So it'll be here for Christmas, but not quite in time for his anniversary. But still, it seemed appropriate, lacking the book, to once again read to you from it. I say I'm always in the time-honored tradition of Swami Kriyananda himself, who has made a long-standing habit of reading to us out of his unpublished manuscripts. In fact, last night on the telephone, he said, Swamiji right now is engaged in writing a commentary on the Bible, which is essentially, well, it won't be comparable to his commentary on the Gita, but it's the other half that Master also commented on. So he said to me last night, oh, are you having a celebration, he said, why don't you read something from my new book? Now, it doesn't really fit anywhere in this program, but I have to keep my word to him, so here's a page. Okay? The reason it's difficult to read from it is the whole first three or four chapters is just a polemic is too strong a word, but he calls this book The True Meaning of Jesus' Teachings as Proclaimed by Paramhansa Yogananda. And because there's so much misunderstanding about the teaching of Christ, he has to first undo all of that before he can go forward. So this is just one page from that book. This is in the great tradition of reading from his unpublished manuscripts. Paramhansa Yogananda belonged in a different category altogether from those who have been declared saints by the Catholic Church. He belonged to no Christian church and came from outside the fold of Christianity completely. He held deep love for Jesus Christ and indeed deep reverence for him. Moreover, he too shared the wisdom attained by the highest of Christian saints and had attained their level of divine inner communion. Coming from outside the Western enclosure, he was free, as the saints within the fold have never been, to speak the truth from his own realization, and had no need to submit whatever he taught to church dignitaries for their approval. He lived in and could speak from God consciousness. Christians who sincerely wanted to know the true message of Jesus Christ were drawn to Yogananda from afar. Some of them came after having received superconscious visions telling them to go to him. Others were attracted by the radiant example of his life, and still others responded because every word he uttered rang with divine truth. Yogananda's divinely revealed insights into the teachings of Christ converted many thousands who, until then, had been hardened skeptics. So, what he's building is the case for saying that the saints are the ones, not the prelates, who know what the church is about. This book that I've written about Swamiji is called Swami Kriyananda as We Have Known Him, which says that it's more than my own experiences. But the way I've sort of begun to say it properly is, it is I who am telling all the stories, but I'm telling them on behalf of many people. So the stories come from different sources, and I'll tell you who they're from if they're other than from me. And they've divided the book into a number of categories. These were not things I knew when I was here last time. And the first category is something called Moments of Truth. And this is a story from Peter Kretzmann. Peter Kretzmann is the son of Mary and Tim. Peter says, I was born at Ananda and have lived here all my life. When I was 6 years old, Swamiji was in the dining room at the retreat. And for some reason, all the children started going up and hugging him. At first, I held back. I didn't want to do it just because everyone else was. Finally, I decided my feelings were sincere, and I went up and put my arms around him. Swamiji was standing up. My head was resting on his heart, and my little arms went only halfway around him. I remember thinking, hugging Swamiji is different than hugging anyone else. It caught me off guard. Waves of peace and joy were coming out of him and going into me. I was so happy just standing there with my head against his heart. I've never forgotten that hug. This one is called Saintly Sweetness. No one was at home at Swamiji's house, so Tim placed the bowl of pudding in the refrigerator. It was a gift to Swamiji from a spiritual teacher known as Sri Ma. Rather than write a note, Tim decided he would just explain it to Swamiji later. But before Tim could tell him about it, Swamiji found the pudding himself. He took a big spoonful. This pudding was made by a saint, Swamiji exclaimed. It is delicious. Who made it? A few friends were in the kitchen with him, but no one knew. The next day, of course, the story came out. But with one bite, Swamiji had already grasped the essentials. This chapter is called, this section is called, the stories, there's many more in each section, but I'm being selective. This one is called God Alone, and it's given to me by an Ananda devotee. In my secretarial jobs before coming to Ananda, it was my practice not only to type the letters my boss gave me, but also to edit them for clarity, grammar, and flow. I enjoyed having something creative to do, and the people I worked for appreciated my contribution. In my first secretarial job at Ananda, I continued in the same way, without bothering to ask the person I worked for now if this was something he wanted. It turned out he didn't want it, emphatically not. I defended my right to make needed improvements to the letters that went out from our office. When Swamiji heard about the controversy, he did not side with me. "I wouldn't want my secretary to edit my letters," he said. "But sir, his letters need editing," I replied. Swamiji answered, "Seek to be the least, and God will give you your rightful place." This is called The Sound of Music, and it's told by Bhagavati. As soon as Swamiji began to sing, it was obvious that the cough and sinus infection he had been battling for months had seriously affected his voice. I am a professional musician, and my heart went out to him. I play the flute, and I know what it is like to try to perform when the body isn't working right. The song was "Where Has My Love Gone?" It is hauntingly beautiful and quite long. His voice was weak and inconsistent, and I projected as much positive energy to him as I could, just to help him get through it. With my sensitive ears, I expected to endure rather than to enjoy his performance. To my astonishment, this turned out to be a truly exquisite performance and a defining moment for me as a musician, because the real secret of Swamiji's musical genius was revealed to me. Until then, I had made the natural mistake of thinking that when Swamiji sang, the beauty of the music came from the sound of his voice. Now, the sound was distorted by his illness, but the music was more beautiful than ever. For the first time, I saw it clearly. Music comes from consciousness. Swamiji's body was impaired, but his spirit was soaring. This realization brought to a clear focus something that had puzzled me for years. I was always something of an anomaly among my classical music colleagues. Before big performances, I would devote comparatively little time to practicing the music itself and an inordinate amount of time to warming up. On my instrument, this meant long, slow tones, which required deep breathing and concentrated attention to every nuance of sound. I knew from experience that if I got myself in order, the music would come out fine. During the performance, I would lose myself in the music in a way that wasn't possible unless I prepared in this way. I understand now that it was my way of meditating. It had never occurred to me, though, until Swamiji showed me with his performance that consciousness is the music. Sound itself is secondary. This section is called Divine Friend and Teacher. It's told by an Ananda devotee. I was on pilgrimage with a group from Ananda. The inspiration of the event was marred for me by grief over personal difficulties I was facing at the time. One bus ride, I was sitting alone, staring sadly out the window. I tried not to be conspicuous, but others must have sensed the cloud of misery around me. Perhaps not knowing how to console me or thinking I wanted to be left alone, no one sat next to me. No one, that is, except Swamiji. He took the seat next to mine, pulled out a harmonium, and began to show me some new chords he had worked out for one of Master's chants. I could barely speak, but I knew on a subtle level he was helping me redirect my energy upward rather than let it sink into a quagmire of pain. Just being in his presence lifted the energy in my spine. One of the purposes of Ananda, Swamiji has said, is to show the world examples of true friendship. Cooperation doesn't have to be coerced. It is the natural result of that friendship. A woman in the community sent Swamiji a note that could have been written by any one of us. "A friend came to me for spiritual counsel," she wrote to Swamiji. "He was tormented by the fear that God does not love him. I did what I could to reassure him, and in the process came to an important realization of my own. I never doubt that God loves me for one simple reason. I have experienced unconditional love from you, Swamiji, as God's instrument. That has given me unshakable faith in God. Swamiji writes, the relationship with God as friend is in some ways the sweetest, he says in his commentary on the Gita. When one thinks of God as friend, there steals into the heart that sweet confidence by which one feels, but of course you love me. I am yours. You are mine. How could either of us ever turn away from the other? We are one. The importance of harmony. Whenever we visited Lugano, Switzerland, I'm telling this story myself, Swamiji would have a treatment he called a pedicure, but had nothing in common with getting your nails painted. It was an hour spent removing calluses and soothing the cracked skin that often afflicted him. When a group of us were vacationing with him in Taormina, Sicily, a friend and I both had conventional pedicures at a beauty shop there. My friend knew that Swamiji enjoyed his pedicure in Lugano and wanted him to have one here, too. When she presented the idea to Swamiji, I tried to explain to her that this was nothing like what he was used to, but she insisted on making an appointment anyway. The shop was some distance from the hotel and up two long flights of steep stairs. It was a strain for Swamiji to make the trek. When we arrived, it was immediately obvious the treatment wasn't anything he wanted, and he left without taking it. On our way back to the hotel, for a few minutes, I was walking alone with Swamiji. He asked me rather insistently, "You knew I wouldn't want that pedicure. Why did you let her make the appointment?" I tried to tell her, I said, but she wouldn't listen. If I had insisted, it would have created disharmony and made her wrong in front of you. I didn't want to do that. Swamiji relaxed completely. "Of course," he said, "you did the right thing." During a period of particularly strenuous work in one of our colonies, people were becoming a little impatient with one another. One person angrily confronted another with a list of his shortcomings. When Swamiji heard about it, he called everyone together. To be fair to both sides, he said, perhaps he needed to have his faults pointed out to him, but should it not have been done in an angry way? Then he went to the real purpose of the meeting. If you do nothing else that I have asked of you, please at least do this. Be kind to each other. The meeting lasted a total of 2 minutes. Swamiji had called them together just to say that. I am not concerned about the details of how things are done, Swamiji has often told us. My only concern is that they be done with the right energy. Right energy above all means harmony. This world is nothing but energy, ruled by magnetism. If the magnetism is wrong, even if you are successful in the short run, in the end, things will not turn out right. If the magnetism is good, especially if you work together in harmony, even if it takes longer, because you have to take into consideration the feelings of others, in the end, you will have a glorious success. That is the secret of Ananda. This story was from an Ananda devotee. It was mid-afternoon, and I had just arrived in Europe from America. Dinner with Swamiji and other friends was set for a few hours later, so I went to my room to rest and freshen up. When evening came, however, and I was supposed to be ready to go out, I was sound asleep in a chair. I had sat down for just a moment, but jet lag overcame me, and now I was dead to the world. When I didn't show up as scheduled, Swamiji came to find me. Seeing me sound asleep, he began gently stroking my cheek with one finger, his touch as light as a feather. There are many ways to wake a person, but I can't imagine one more considerate than the way Swamiji chose. Ever since then, when the occasion arises, I awaken people the same way. I will never forget the feeling of gradually being drawn back to the world by that gentle gesture. In itself, it was a trivial event, but it affected me deeply. It seemed to epitomize years of friendship and loving guidance from Swamiji. Calm acceptance of our weaknesses, willingness to work with us as we are, a remarkable sensitivity to the needs of the moment, and the patient application of kindness and respect in all circumstances. Swamiji's life is rich with profound incidents. I have witnessed many of them. Yet one of my most precious memories is how he took such care in waking up a friend when nothing more was at stake than going out to dinner. Omnipresence, Swamiji said, encompasses not only the infinite, but also the infinitesimal. This section is called First Impressions. This one is called Light or Dark. These are stories of just people the first time they met Swami or the first time they cognized him. This one is told by Krishnadas from Ananda Village. When I met Swamiji for the first time, I didn't know anything about him or Master. I hadn't even read Autobiography of a Yogi. I had been practicing Hatha Yoga for a couple of years at the Yoga Institute in Houston, Texas, where I lived. Swamiji was giving a free lecture there, and I was intrigued by the idea of meeting a real Swami. I arrived late, and the only seats left were in the front row, which suited me fine. I wanted to be close. Swamiji was on a nationwide tour, and about a dozen people were traveling with him. The program started with a few songs by the Gandharvas, as the Ananda singers were called then. The visual impression they made was a little disconcerting. Everyone I knew who was into yoga had a hip, kind of city vibe. The Gandharvas didn't have any of that. They looked like what they were, devotees from a rural ashram. When I closed my eyes, though, and listened, I forgot all of that. The music was sublime. The first visual impression I got of Swamiji was also unusual. With his beard and long hair and orange Indian-style clothes, he didn't look like anyone I had ever seen before. When he began to speak, I closed my eyes so I could concentrate better. Instantly, I was catapulted into a deep place within myself where I'd never been before. I felt I was drinking from the depths of Swamiji's peace. His voice echoed and re-echoed within me as if my insides were a huge empty cavern. Gradually, though, his consciousness began to fill my inner emptiness, and the echoing subsided. Once or twice I opened my eyes, but quickly shut them again. Nothing outside was as interesting as what was going on within me. Eventually, the program came to an end. I felt like I was coming back from another world. It shocked me to see that people were leaving the hall. "Where are you going?" I wanted to shout out to them. "Didn't you hear what he said? This man has the answers. He knows the truth." Then, for just a moment, I doubted. "I guess it's over," I thought, and I too stood up and started to leave. But when I turned toward the exit door, my body felt sluggish and I could hardly move, and the exit door turned into a huge black hole that was sucking people out of the room. I turned back and faced Swamiji, who was still on the stage talking to a few people gathered around him. This direction, I saw nothing but bright light, and my body felt relaxed and free. Once again, I turned toward the exit door. "Don't go there!" my inner voice cried. That was enough for me. I turned toward the light and never looked at the door again. Swamiji gave programs all weekend, and I spent every minute I could with him. By the time it was over, I was moving into a newly formed Ananda ashram in Houston, even though I barely knew what an ashram was. 6 months later, I was living at Ananda Village. That first experience with Swamiji was like hooking into a spiritual tractor beam, which has guided my life ever since. This story is from Karen. I was walking around a New Age fair called the Whole Life Expo, enjoying the wide variety of booths and people. A psychic from a nearby booth called out to me to come over and talk to her. She pointed down the aisle and asked, "Who is that man?" "The one with the white hair, wearing the white jacket." I looked where she was indicating and saw the back of a familiar figure as he walked down the aisle. I smiled. "That's Swami Kriyananda from Ananda Village. He's here to give a talk. She leaned over toward me and said in a voice filled with reverence, I have never seen an aura anything like that before. That soul is very rare on earth. He lives only to do God's will. These are stories from the chapter called In Service to His Guru. This one's called Retraction. It was Spiritual Renewal Week, and Swamiji was giving the morning class. He started talking about a subtle point, how people who are highly advanced spiritually can still have serious flaws in their character. Think of light shining through a stained glass window, he said. When the light is dim, the colors all look gray, and you can't see the flaws in the glass. When the sun shines brightly, the colors are revealed, but so also is every flaw. So it is on the spiritual path. As a devotee advances, his energy increases, and everything about him becomes more apparent, both his strengths and his weaknesses. To illustrate the point, Swamiji began to talk about one of his brother disciples. He was advanced spiritually and very close to master, Swamiji said, but he could also be jealous and petty in ways you wouldn't expect in such an advanced soul. Swamiji didn't say this in a judgmental way. He just stated it as a fact. It was an interesting point. And when Swamiji suddenly went silent, at first we thought he was just giving us time to absorb what he had said. Swamiji was completely still, his head slightly turned as if listening to something none of us could hear. Finally, Swamiji resumed speaking. In a quiet, serious tone of voice, he said, When I speak, I try to be a channel for Master. He is not pleased with me for saying those things about my brother disciple. Please consider them unsaid. Then Swamiji described that disciple again, this time speaking only of his many fine spiritual qualities. It was striking to me how subtle Swamiji is in his attunement to Master, and how unconcerned he was about embarrassing himself in front of us by admitting his error. The only thing that matters to Swamiji is that he please Master. Over the years, this is told by Padma, it's called Special Thanks. Over the years, I have had different roles at Ananda. First, I was in the financial department, then I took over the publishing. Now, my husband and I head the Ananda Colony and Church in Seattle, Washington. I'm still involved in publishing, though. I coordinate the foreign rights. Swamiji's books are published in 100 different countries and in some 28 languages, so it is almost a half-time job. Foreign rights is the key to spreading the teachings around the world, so Swamiji has always been pleased to see the growth in this aspect of the work. Many times he has expressed his gratitude to me, for all that has been accomplished, but he has never thanked me for doing any one project or any specific thing. What Swamiji says is, thank you for helping. This is the essence of karma yoga. We are all serving, and in that sense, helping God. There is nothing personal about it, not his role, not mine. We are just smoothing the way for what is trying to happen. Often, when a decision has to be made, Swamiji will put it just that way. What is trying to happen? It is not a question of what Swamiji wants or what any of us want. This is a divine work. We are all God's instruments. A few months after he moved to India in 2003, Swamiji came down with a nearly fatal case of pneumonia. He was barely breathing and had to be rushed to the hospital in the middle of the night. Ever since he had arrived in India, his health had been deteriorating. Even when I was a young man, Swamiji said, I found the climate in India difficult. At this age, it may kill me. Swamiji invited Dharmadas and Nirmala to come from Ananda Village to be leaders of the work in India. Now, a few months after coming to live in a country they had never even visited before, they faced the real possibility that Swamiji's health was not up to the challenge. If he had to leave India or if the climate killed him, then it would be up to them to make the work happen. Fortunately, Swamiji recovered. Gradually, his overall health improved, and he didn't have to leave India. But on the day he was checking out of the hospital after the pneumonia, the future seemed uncertain. Swamiji was resting on the bed. He asked Nirmala and Dharmanas to come sit on the bed with him, holding their right hands in both of his. He looked deeply into their eyes. "This work does not belong to me," he said. "It does not belong to you. This work belongs to Babaji and to Master. It is their will we must follow, not our own. If we do that, you'll see that this work will develop beautifully in ways you can't even imagine now." This was a dramatic expression of what Swamiji has been saying to me all these years. This is a divine work, and it is our privilege to be helping. Now comes a section called "For Joy I Live," and these are more humorous moments. This first one is called "Pajamas with Roses." It's told by Hridaya. It was late at night after a lecture when Swamiji discovered someone had driven off with his car keys. He was on tour, staying an hour out of town. Rather than inconvenience someone by asking him to drive back with the keys, Swamiji accepted our invitation to sleep in the guest room at my in-law's house, where my husband and I were also staying. None of the men had a spare set of pajamas to loan him, so I gave Swamiji a pair of mine. I was 6 months pregnant, and a friend had made the pajamas big enough for me to wear until the baby was born. In fact, I could have carried a 3-year-old child inside those pajamas with me. They were huge. The pattern was red roses as big as dinner plates, printed on a white background. Very festive. We had all retired for the night when we heard a gentle knock at our bedroom door. It was Swamiji. "Are you awake?" he asked in a low voice. "I have something to show you." When we opened the door, Swamiji sailed in wearing the rose pajamas, then walked and turned like a runway model showing off his outfit. He knew how ludicrous he looked and hadn't wanted to wait until morning to share the humor with us. The next day, he also entertained my in-laws with his runway model routine. Then he did his energization exercises and ate breakfast with the family, still wearing those ridiculous pajamas. My mother-in-law had never met Swamiji before. She was so impressed by his humility and his complete lack of self-importance that she went and found a book of his we had given her as a gift. She had never read it. It had been sitting on her shelf for months. Now she brought it to the breakfast table, and as respectfully as you could speak to someone clad in those rose pajamas, asked Swamiji to autograph it for her. In the summer, this is told by Ananda, it's called "Give Your All." In the summer, Swamiji often invited people over on Saturday afternoon to enjoy the swimming pool at Crystal Hermitage. One afternoon, the men started playing a game of horse and rider. One man would get on the shoulders of another, and the two riders would wrestle until one of the other was knocked into the water. Swamiji entered the game as a rider. He is 20 years older than the men he was playing against, but he was strong and has enormous willpower. Everyone who went up against him was quickly defeated. Of course, the men were a little half-hearted in their efforts. After all, they were fighting against Swamiji. Then my husband Bharat got into the game. There was nothing half-hearted about the way he played. Bharat loves competition and was determined to win. I was horrified. It was all in good fun, but pushing and grabbing did not seem to me the way to treat your spiritual teacher. Bharat is strong and he fought hard. It took time for Swamiji to defeat him, but eventually Bharat tumbled into the water and the game ended with a big splash and then a burst of laughter. My only comfort was at least Bharat hadn't won. But I shouldn't have worried. The next day at Sunday service, Swamiji described the scene in the pool, graciously omitting any reference to who had won or lost. Then he praised Bharat for the determined way he played the game. "It takes energy to succeed," Swamiji said appreciatively. "If you're going to do something, you should give it everything you've got." This one is called "Saved by a Nose," and it's from Happy Winningham. "I had been living with AIDS for 4 years, and now I also had spinal meningitis. By the time my friends got me to the emergency room at the hospital, my condition was so serious, even a trip up in the elevator to intensive care would have taken too much time away from the immediate need to save my life. doctors, nurses, admitting administrators, and a crowd of Ananda friends surrounded me as I was wheeled into a small room near the entrance. The meningitis had caused my brain to swell, creating a pain that was indescribable. I was dehydrated, my blood pressure was non-existent, and I was going in and out of consciousness. The administrator kept asking me for my Blue Shield insurance card, while nurses poked needles into me again and again in a desperate effort to find a vein that hadn't collapsed so they could start an IV. Not realizing the seriousness of the situation, a well-meaning friend had brought a bouquet of helium balloons, cheerful faces painted on a red and gold surface. In my delirium, they looked like astral boogeymen hovering on the ceiling, taunting me as I prepared to exit from this world. Thinking that the end was near, a friend started leading me in a visualization down the tunnel of light into the astral world. Vital signs and hope were dropping. Every thought echoed goodbye. At that moment, Swamiji walked in. He sat down on a chair by the bed, wedged in between the doctors and nurses who were frantically working on me. I was able to open my eyes enough to acknowledge his presence. My extremities had already begun to die. My hands and feet had turned blue. My nose was bright purple, and the color was spreading across my cheeks. I was a frightening spectacle. Swamiji looked carefully at my face. Then he smiled and said, "Happy, you look like Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer." At these words, the whole room froze, as if someone had pushed a cosmic pause button. Then I smiled, and a surge of energy went through me that allowed me to laugh. Some of the nurses laughed too, and everyone began to relax, easing into Swamiji's aura of calm, detached acceptance. At that point, everything changed. The nurse found a vein. The administrator found my insurance card. The IV started. My blood pressure began to rise, and hope returned. Swamiji taught me many lessons that day. The most cherished among them is this simple thought: the way to overcome negativity and fear is to meet it head on with joy. I'll just read a couple of more. This section is called Grace. This is a lovely section. I'll just read two here. Healing Touch, told by an Ananda devotee. From childhood, I carried a deep sadness. Even as a little girl, I knew it came from a past life in which I had experienced the traumatic death of a beloved spouse. It was a kind of post-traumatic stress syndrome that spanned more than one incarnation. Sometimes when I was a child, the grief was more than I could bear, and I would weep uncontrollably. As I grew older, and especially after I got onto the spiritual path, I made progress in resolving it, but much grief remained. I didn't know what else to do except pray and accept that the grief might be with me for the rest of my life. I could feel the karma as a knot of energy lodged in my spine, just behind my heart. One evening, after I had been living at Ananda Village for many years, I went with my husband to a community musical event. The concert was a birthday gift for Swamiji. As part of the program, a group played selections from his album, Secrets of Love. The music uplifted me and at the same time made me aware of my inner grief. I didn't want any unhappiness to mar the evening for Swamiji, so I prayed to Divine Mother, "Please don't let my sadness touch his joy." During the intermission, Swamiji came to where my husband and I were sitting with a group of friends. He stood between us, with one hand on my husband's shoulder and the other hand on my spine. His fingers were right where I felt the karma was lodged. I felt a tremendous pressure from his hand, an enormous energy going into me. Swamiji didn't make a point of what he was doing. The whole time he chatted casually with the others. He didn't, however, speak to me, but let me receive his energy in silence. A few minutes later, Swamiji took his hand away. The knot of energy was gone, and with it the sadness I had known all my life. Every once in a while since then, a shadow of it has crossed my consciousness, just enough to make me continuously grateful to Swamiji for taking that karma away. I'll end with this last little one. The story is told by Nalini. Nalini was my first Ananda friend, so this story is particularly touching to me. Spiritually, I have been fortunate. I came to Ananda at an early age and have never wavered in my commitment and devotion to this path. For many years, however, my personal life was tumultuous. 2 divorces, cancer, and years of crippling self-doubt. Through all that long, difficult time, Swamiji's patience with me has been nothing less than heroic. Dozens of times he counseled me for substantially the same reasons, offering the same advice, couched in different words according to the context at the time. God loves you. Don't give up. Keep offering your devotion to him. You can do it. I know you can. There was no one dramatic moment when my life changed completely. Swamiji's influence has been like water on a stone, at first imperceptible, then gradually over time, carving into the rough surface of my ego a smooth receptacle for God's love. My life story will not be written in large letters across the pages of history. Mine has been a humble life. In his poem Samadhi, Master offers divine reassurance to devotees like me. The sparrow, each grain of sand, fall not without my sight. I am like the sparrow. Many times I have fallen. Each time, God has noticed, and through Swamiji's love, lifted me up again. Now we'll take a few moments, and you may come to the altar as you feel to and offer a flower in gratitude to the Masters and to Swamiji.